So we are people of the city. I mean, overwhelmingly, that is true. Apologies to people in rural and regional Australia, but you know what I mean. The city, likewise, overwhelmingly, will be where COVID-19 is both caught and fought. And those cities, they are now changed places, changed spaces. This can be in benign but purposeful ways, that the copper tape over traffic light buttons in the city of Melbourne. On the other side, it's the more extreme and starker expressions of that change in our urban spaces of fear and isolation, emptiness, makeshift hospitals, strange reconfigurings of our urban social life. What will our cities be on the other side of this? And what obstacles do they impose to the response to this crisis? Or perhaps what opportunities does the urban environment offer in dealing with COVID-19? To discuss this, two gentlemen, both academics from York University in Toronto. Harris Ali is Professor of Sociology and Roger Keel is Professor at the Faculty of Environmental Studies. Roger, what does the study of urbanism tell us about a moment like this and you know, the capacity of the city to perhaps deal with something like COVID-19?
I think that cities and disease have always been tied by the hip. This has always been a connection that was, for good or for bad, there in human history. These were considered to be unclean, unhygienic, until very recently when we established public health institutions and simple hygienic measures like running water and sewer systems, these kinds of things. That only really happened in the industrialized world throughout the 20th century, but throughout the rest of history, this has always been a complicated environment. Now, having said that, the current crisis is particular because for the first time a number of years ago, in the beginning of the 2000s, we had a moment when two things happened at the same time. The majority of the world's population lived in cities, which was never the case in the history of humanity. And secondly, we had an outbreak in 2003 of a coronavirus by the name of SARS. And it affected mostly what we at the time called global cities. And those global cities are the financial centers, the decision-making centers in Australia. That would be mostly Sydney, but also, of course, Melbourne, to some degree, Perth as a city of mining. But we found at the time that the outbreak of SARS had something to do with this particular form of globalization, which was concentrated and focused on these global cities. Now, the current outbreak is similar to that, but it's also completely different because the type of urbanization that we see today is so much different from what we have seen in the past. And that is something that we need to understand better, and that's something that we're trying to study in our work.
That thing that Roger mentions there, Harris, of the SARS outbreak, and that is very interesting in the way in which cities have responded to COVID-19. That cities with an experience of SARS and with what's required in that circumstance have perhaps dealt a little better.
Yeah, I mean, the idea is with the past experience, certain lessons were learned and people respond to those lessons, right? Because in most of these cities where the outbreaks occurred with SARS, they had a public commissioned inquiry investigating what happened, what were the best practices. And so technically, there have been certain positive responses. Hospitals have set up negative pressure containment units to keep the virus from flowing out. They've invested in having more compatible data platforms so that the epidemiological data could be shared between the local public health office and the provincial level and the federal level. And these sorts of technical improvement certainly have come about, and particularly with advanced digitalization and the social media and all this sort of stuff. It has indeed, as you were alluding to, led to a better response, technically speaking.
It's interesting, Roger, what you say about that history of the city and that slow creation of an increasingly safe environment. And in a way, this outbreak confounds our impression of that urban environment, the one that we took to be safe, that we thought had become almost a sort of an urban paradise in so many ways, or at least a safe place. Mm-hmm. Now it feels less so.
Yeah, it's true to some degree, but that was also true to the latter half or the latter quarter, one should say, of the 20th century, when people thought infectious disease was a thing of the past. We had conquered infectious disease. That was the language used, and you can see that language today. It's this idea we as humanity can conquer disease. We can win over this. The politicians like to say we can win this war against the disease. But we had fooled ourselves in believing that we had done everything that was needed to be done to fight these diseases. Partly it was because the measures that were taken in the face of diseases that we knew. But those diseases that we're talking about now are so-called emerging infectious diseases. Those diseases have never confronted humanity. So while we have an experience to deal with the flu, the common flu, that is not quite the case with diseases like Ebola, Zika, and now the coronavirus. So we are now beginning to have to live with new outbreaks and new types of viruses that for which we have not created the institutional knowledge, we have not created the medical knowledge, the epidemiological knowledge to deal with. And that is a growing challenge, as some people would argue that we now have an acceleration of these kinds of outbreaks, and they seem to be coming at us every few years from different kinds of places, right? So we are beginning to learn how to react to these various outbreaks in as they come at us.
It's almost, Harris, as though our urban structure is under attack. Our cities, to some extent, now become a fortress against an external force.
Yeah, that's actually an interesting observation, and it's actually historically based because, in the olden days in Europe and all over perhaps Asia as well, you dealt with cities as walled city-states. They had their fortress around them, fortified to keep people out, invaders out, and this sort of thing. And even in the olden days when quarantine was imposed, it was more easier done because there was literally a wall around the city, right? So you kept the outsiders out. You kept anyone who was suspected of having a disease at the port. This is where the term quarantine comes from, that the ships coming into the city-state of Venice, they were quarantined to port 40 days, and if the sailors showed no symptoms, then they could come into the city. But nowadays, with globalization, with the flow of information, of labor, capital, people, resources, cargo, digital information, currency, you have much more porous borders. You don't have this walled city state. It doesn't even make sense to talk about cities in that sense. You just have a more porous borders. And this is part of what globalization is about, right? So not only do you have all this porosity open to all these things that I've just mentioned, but also to infectious diseases as well. And this should be a sort of characteristics of cities in the global age, so to speak.
And that, Roger, that's the big picture within the individual city. And a lot of your work is around this notion of suburbanism. And this has been part of the character of the modern city, that it has a core and then an increasingly spreading field of often under-resourced, under-infrastructured suburban areas. How does that play into our treatment of COVID-19?
Yeah, this is a very important point, particularly in a country like Australia, which I believe is the most suburbanized country in the world. I spent a month there earlier last year and had a good impression of that. So I think this is something that particularly those countries like Canada and Australia, the United States, and other countries have to face, that we have now a sprawling urban form. We have a form that seems to never end. So in contrast to what Harris said about the walled cities of the past, we now have an extended city. But not only are these cities extended in themselves and hence have those unequal distributions of service delivery and all of this that you mentioned, but also it is now the case that it's not just as we assumed with SARS that the city centers were connected, the airports were connected to the cities in other parts of the world, but it's now a particular suburb of a particular city in Australia or in Germany that can be connected to a particular suburb in China, like in Wuhan, where there is an automobile industry. And so car parts that are produced in one suburb of on one continent are connected to factories that are in the suburb of another continent. So we have a much more complex relationship of particular parts of that extended urban form with other places around the world. And that is really a significant change over any type of urbanization that we had before in the history of the world.
And that, of course, Roger, poses all sorts of problems in dealing with this current issue and exacerbates some of the existing issues around resourcing of these far-flung cities. They now stand in the way of resolving this pandemic.
It does very much so. I mean, one thing that we already mentioned is this question of are the service institutions, the health institutions and so on, prepared in those sprawling suburbs? Is that urban form more or less prepared for an onslaught of an epidemiological event? But also the question is, what other things are happening at those peripheries? So in Australia or in Canada, one of the things that is so significant, which also is significant in Africa, where there has been a faster acceleration of Ebola outbreaks, is the question of what role does mining play? What role does the pushing of the urban frontier into the bush play in this? You've had this problem exemplified in the fires last year in Australia and in Canada, it's the same thing. But now we have those same kinds of issues around the boundaries of cities when it comes to disease. Partly, this is related to the core problem of these types of emerging infectious diseases, which we call zoonotic diseases. Those are diseases that jump the species boundary between animals and humans. And so if we push farther into the bush, farther into areas that have never been lived in by humans and have never been urbanized, then we risk continuously to open ourselves up to more risk of that kind. And that was certainly different in the classical city, which was more compact and more pedestrian in that sense, and less expanded and extended as they are now.
Harris, that notion that you mentioned earlier of that readily walled city, the containable ancient city where quarantine is almost second nature, this phenomenon now of the broadened suburbanized city and with this particular disease having hotspots, having, you know, small suburban areas as its focus within those broader cities, what does that do to what is necessary to combat it, the social solidarity that we need to confront a virus of this type when it's not a thing broadly of those city spaces but is focused in specific areas?
Yeah, I think this is a chief challenge to locate exactly those areas that tend to be hidden or latent. I mean, one of the things with infectious diseases almost across the spectrum is that these infectious diseases hide in those communities where the people are the most vulnerable, the most disenfranchised, the most marginalized. Mm-hmm. Tuberculosis is the most prominent example of that. It's almost like the infectious diseases hide in these pockets of poverty. You know, when you talk about the cities, especially in the developing world, and you can talk about these mega slums, and the diseases do hide there because of the conditions. But today, with the modern city, and getting to your kind of question more directly, it's like today you have the cities with the suburbs. And you may have new sort of issues coming up in these sort of suburbs. For example, you may have, in the past, people who would immigrate to a new country would oftentimes go into the urban centers. But more and more such people are settling down in the suburbs. And so certain problems that used to be associated with only urban centers, the inner core and so on, are being now faced in the suburbs. For example, homelessness, and not just homelessness of individuals as people stereotypically associate with the urban core, but the homelessness of entire families, and these are often in the suburbs, right? So this adds another complicating component to the fight against infectious diseases.
And I wonder, Roger, it's too soon for this sort of speculation perhaps, but on the other side of this pandemic, how do you think we will respond? Will we adjust those almost endemic issues of inequality within our cities that Harris mentions there? Or do you think this outbreak, will that entrench that sense? Will those who are privileged within our cities seek to even further entrench that privilege to barricade themselves against a hostile world?
Well, it's up to us, isn't it? I mean, this is a big political question, and that is really an important political question that we see that people are jockeying for position right now. There is a big fight right now in our jurisdictions in Canada, also in other jurisdictions around the world, whether tenants should pay the rent. There is now a political movement afoot in Toronto to actually collectively go on a rent strike to say that no tenants pay rent anywhere, no residential tenants pay rent, because people can't go to work, they're in a difficult situation. That is one possible outcome of this, that people say that. But when they say that, that could have consequences for the future to say, why are we even structuring our cities in particular ways, owning, renting, these forms of tenure? How do we deal with this? On the other hand, the platforms like Airbnb and the big rental companies are also organizing. They're trying to get bailouts from the government. So this is a political fight. And it is a political fight that could be a one-in-a-generation kind of fight. It could lay the path, the direction for other decisions that are made down the road. So you're absolutely right. This is a critical moment, not only in the way in which our cities will be structured and built and so on, but also in which our societies function. And it's significant to understand that at the beginning of this crisis, everybody said, look at the Chinese, what they're doing. It's an authoritarian state. They do this, they do that. And we in the West would never do these things. But now we have almost all the governments in the West imposing some form of state of exception. Our cities, the streets are empty. People are forced to stay at home. These are completely different ways of connecting to one another. What I find hopeful at that time is we now see many, many forms of social solidarity in the shadow of the authoritarian measures taken by the state. That gives me hope.
Just in closing, Harris, I mean, this is possibly, as Roger suggests there, an extraordinarily rare opportunity for social reframing.
Yes, no, absolutely, I would agree with this. I mean, almost all disasters have this possibility. I mean, one of the things that comes up often in disaster management research is this concept of resilience, of bouncing back. But really, the key political question is bouncing back from what and towards what, right? And,
yes,
you know, the towards what is important because, are you going to improve to a better state of existence? Are you going to improve to a state where you address social inequality or to improve society, right?
Well, positive potential, I think, is a thing that we can cling to in these these dark days. Look, thank you both.
Thank you very much, Jonathan.
Harris Ali and Roger Keel, both from York University in Toronto. And on Radio National, this is Blueprint.